When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And the RNC now makes staffers answer if the 2020 election was stolen. They have to make sure you'll lie about that. We have such an interesting show for you today. Domestic policy advisor to President Biden, Neera Tanden, stops by to talk to us about the Republican war on reproductive rights and health more generally. Then we'll talk to historian Thomas Zimmer about his deep dive into the Heritage Foundation and their plan for Project 2025. It's actually fascinating and terrifying. But first, we have NBC National Affairs correspondent John Heilman. Welcome back to Fast Politics, John. Thank you.
Hey, Molly, you were like on Morning Joe. And, you know, I like nothing I like better when I'm in Los Angeles and I wake up at 3 a.m. to watch the 6 a.m. hour of Morning Joe live because I, you know, that's the kind of psychopath I am.
So let's talk about the vibe shift in American politics. I mean, there certainly is a lot of anxiety about RFK Jr. and Nicole Shanahan, but it's not clear that he can get, you know, he still has had trouble getting on the ballot. He's almost completely funded by a Republican. I mean, it seems like there's a larger vibe shift in this world's longest general election. Yes, no? I mean, what do you feel here?
Molly, one of the few advantages to being in my age, my rapidly encroaching decrepitude and senility is that I've done some of these races before. And
yes.
So like the momentary vibe shift is like it's one of my mortal enemies. People overstated the degree to which Joe Biden was dead and toast and
right.
Donald Trump's going to kill Joe Biden. And people now, especially in the liberal media, will seize on a couple of polls and claim, and the combination of a series of things. He did really well at the State of the Union. There are a couple of polls that show there's been a State of the Union bounce. Trump is obviously having all the problems he's having, although those are ongoing. And people will now say, there's a bit of a vibe shift, and we all think that Biden's bouncing back. My view, you may not ever want to have me back on the podcast again, because I'll say the same thing.
No, don't worry.
Which is, the race is going to be really close, and it's going to be really close. Vibe shifts don't take place within the margin of error, but polling shifts do. It's
right.
always been a margin of error race. It's still a margin of error race. It's going to be a margin of error race until Election Day. And there are somewhere between 5 and 7 states that will determine the outcome. The numbers of votes that will determine the outcome is tiny. And so small things that will happen much closer to Election Day can be determinative. And the thing about RFK is that the third party problem is a real problem for Biden. And some of these people are going to get on tickets. It looks like that they may the Biden people, that is, may be fortunate in that No Labels doesn't seem like it's going to be able to put a candidate on the ballot, which would have been bad for them. The RFK thing is a bit of a conundrum. The Trump people think that RFK is the only one of the potential third party candidates who could hurt Trump because of the fact that it's not just a Republican donor, but, you know, he connects to a lot of these anti-vax people, and those are Trump people. So, you know, he's obviously going to take some votes away from both of them because he's a Kennedy on one side and he's also anti-vax on the other side. He's a wild card. But I thought for a year and continue to think that the race is a margin of error race and it's going to be really, really close. And I don't think anything is going to change my view about that. When someone starts polling consistently ahead or behind of the other person outside the margin of error, incredible polls, we could have a conversation about vibe shifts. I mean, I'm not dissing the question. I'm just saying,
No.
I think that people who thought Biden was dead overstated the case. And I think people who think that somehow Biden's going to cruise to re-election are out of their minds. I think the reality is it's going to be really hard fought and that he is perfectly capable to win the race, Joe Biden is. And I would even, I continue to say that I make him a slight favorite in winning the race. But I would have said that 3 weeks ago or 3 months ago, just as much. And I do think the State of the Union is really, if you really think about vibe shifts in terms of people's just the Democratic bedwetting reducing in volume and volume reach, and maybe it's cooling a bit. It's not quite as warm, the bedwetting, you know, they're like everything's chilled. They're chilling a little bit. Is the State of the Union is the key element of that. It's like to see Biden get over to perform like that. And then to see a little bit of movement in the numbers has reduced a very bunch of very nervous Nellies. They're a little bit nervous now. So that's, yes, there's a little bit of a vibe shift. But again, I think the underlying data suggests super close. Biden probably the slight favorite, but Trump could win. And I think that everybody should just fix that in their brains right now. That's really the underlying dynamics of the race are like that and are going to be like that probably until November.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad way to think about any presidential campaign or race.
So when you look at a poll and the poll has a margin of error in it, right? And you see the margin of error says margin of error 3 points. That means the margin of error applies to both people's numbers. So if you want to know what the margin of error is, you multiply it by 2. It's really 6. What that means is like Joe Biden could be up 42-37 over Donald Trump or 52-47 in a 3% margin of error race. And that's still within the margin of error because the 3 points applies to Biden could be up 3 or down 3 from what the number is that they have for him. And Trump could be up 3 or down 3. So in a 3-point margin of error race, you know, you could be up by 5 and you're still within the margin of error. You can be down by 5 and you're still within the margin of error. And people think that like, look at that number and think, oh, it's if it's beyond 3, but the lead is bigger than 3 points, it's outside the margin of error. That's not true. It's got to be out more than 6. So like it's the margin of these polls. If people haven't learned anything, it's really, I mean, it's helpful to remember because people make the mistake on television all the time. The polls, it's one of the things that should reinforce people's, another thing that a lot of people feel in their gut after the last couple cycles in particular, the polls have been proven wrong in a variety of ways over, you know, in 2016, in 2020, in a lot of the midterm polling. It's like everybody should be looking more at directions and trend lines of polls than that the precise number. Oh, Joe Biden's up by 1. Joe Biden is never up by 1. Donald Trump is never up by 1. That's always within the margin of error. It's meaningless. If you start to see trend lines that show consistently in high quality polls that one side is that the gap is widening in one direction or the other, that's what you should be paying attention to. And I always just say that only to just reinforce the notion, to go back to the top point. Hey guys, it's going to be a close race and there's going to be some ups and downs and there's going to be some moments when people think Biden is just dead and there's going to be some moments where people think Trump is just dead. And I think of all things, unless somebody gets hit by a bus or there is a Martian invasion, the reality is that like this is going to be a really close race until November.
It is a good point, though, that Biden has many points in midterms. I mean, I wrote a piece in The Washington Post that said he should drop out. I mean, he has been declared dead many, many times. Like that's sort of his favorite thing.
Yes. I mean, look, people, famously Barack Obama told him he couldn't beat Donald Trump in 2016 and he should let Hillary Clinton take the reins. And you know how that worked out. You know, people said he couldn't win the Democratic nomination in 2020 because the party was too progressive and Bernie and Elizabeth Warren now had driven the party to the left and he could never, ever win the Democratic nomination. And then, he got crushed in Iowa, got crushed in New Hampshire. He was definitely dead after those two things.
Yeah, that's when I wrote that story.
He goes on and sweeps the race, right? People said he couldn't beat Trump from the basement and then he beats Trump 2020. People said that he couldn't get anything done in a bipartisan way on Capitol Hill, and then he gets the infrastructure bill passed. People said the Democrats are going to get crushed in the 2022 midterms, and that didn't happen. If you did a thought bubble over Biden's head, whenever he hears anyone say, we should throw this to an open convention, like if James Carville, who I love and respect, but when James Carville or Ezra Klein or someone says, hey, open convention, get Biden out of there. What Biden thinks is. You're the same people who said, I couldn't win the nomination, couldn't beat Trump, couldn't succeed in Congress, couldn't have a decent midterm in 2022. Fuck you. Like, you all have been naysaying me for years, and I've proven you wrong time and time again. Now, on the other side of that, that's static analysis from Biden's point of view, because he is older. Go back and watch Biden's announcement speech in 2020, in May of 2019, and compare it to how he speaks now. He's older. You know, he's not as robust. He's not as full of energy. He's not as clear. He's not as, you know, a lot of things. So he has gotten older. He's not as good a candidate as he was in 2020. That's not some huge shot at Biden. You know, a lot of candidates in that age group, if you 4 years later, are going to be worse. But it's not a perfect riposte to the point that, you know, people are worried about Biden's performance, but to say, hey, I won. You guys were doubters before and I proved you wrong. What you have to do is you have to keep proving it now. And that's why the State of the Union was important, because that's not telling people, you guys doubted me before and you were wrong. That's showing people that you can still have the energy, have the clarity, have the force, have the fight in you that you can take Donald Trump on. If you can show them day after day, that's the thing that will back off people from their bedwetting. And again, I think that's why that if there's a moment here where people are feeling a little less suicidal than they were 2 months ago, it's because of that combo of Trump is, you know, the money thing and all the stuff we know. We could talk about Trump all day long, but the Biden, a little bit of a Biden, you know, the first time he's seen upward movement in his polling in a long time. And then this very vivid performance is like why people, and I think people are, you know, I mean, in the end, I don't really care that much about Democratic bedwetters because I don't think that they really are going to determine who wins the race in the end. But it is the case that a lot of the people that you and I run into in the green room at Morning Joe are a little calmer than they were couple months ago.
You know, one of the things I think of you as doing is like you go to everywhere, right? You go to Iowa. You know, you're like a person who goes to like the important political places. Well, also Los Angeles, which is not very important politically.
I usually hit about 30 states a year. So it's like I, you know, one way or the other. And sometimes it's more, you know, if it's a primary season, I'll be in places like Iowa and South Carolina and New Hampshire. But I travel a lot and not just back and forth from LA to New York. I end up getting to a lot of places for various reasons. And so I end up talking to a lot of people who are, I don't want to say like I'm out like David Broder knocking on doors and talking to, quote, average voters. I'm not like sitting in Manhattan most of the time or in D.C.
I feel that.
So I get to at least, you know, whether it's small business. I mean, I give speeches and stuff, but, you know, so it's whether it's a, you know, a pharmaceutical company board or something in Arizona, people like, oh, you know, well, I kind of, oh, you're on the speaking circuit. But the truth is, if you go and talk to the board of a pharma company or a healthcare company or a real estate management company in Florida, you know, you're meeting, you know, lots of people who are, they're not the coastal elites and they're not in the Acela corridor class. And they think about politics from the standpoint of what do my taxes look like? What are interest rates look like? What are my employees telling me all the time? And you get a little bit of a sense, a little bit better sense of like what the mood of the country is when you go around, no matter how unscientific it is, you kind of get some sense of a kind of ambient sense of where people's heads are at. And usually it kind of comports with the polling. And I would, and the broad sense, and I'd say that, you know, to answer the question that I think you're going to ask, you can't gauge like the week to week movements of like anything. It's, but you can get a sense. And I just would say that like my overwhelming sense of for the last year has been liberal, moderate, conservative, everyone has been, if I had to write a book about this campaign, it would be, is this really the best we can do? You know, that's what you hear from people. And I hear from Democrats all the time. This is not an anti-Biden thing. You know, Democrats who say, I know Joe Biden is better than Donald Trump. I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. I know he's on democracy side and Donald Trump is a fascist. And I know that there's no false equivalency here. As a citizen, I look at these two octogenarians and say, is this really the best America? Is this really the two best people who could compete for the presidency? And again, I hear that from liberals as much as I hear it from moderates and conservatives. People are just a little bit like, huh, okay. If this is the choice, I know what I'm going to do, but I'm not like, oh yeah, I'm really psyched about this. I mean, on either side, frankly, it's the Trump people. You hear that from a lot of Republicans too. They're not psyched about Trump.
I actually have Republican friends. People are always shocked by this. Who were like, you know, very in Trump world, who are like hesitantly just going to go along with it this time because you can't not.
Right.
But here's my question for you. Like, this was originally this very bad Senate map for Democrats. I talked to, you know, someone in Florida was talking about how they think they're probably going to be able to get abortion on the ballot in Florida. They got 1 million signatures, 100,000 Republicans on that. There's a theory of the case, or at least there's some sort of green shoots of hope that these bottom up candidates might move the ticket along. I mean, am I wish casting?
A little bit, but I don't think, I mean, not necessarily a lot. I mean, here's one way of thinking about what we've seen in American politics post Dobbs in this Biden era in general has been, you know, Democrats underperforming in polling and overperforming on election day. And one of the things that people who are serious in the business point to and say is that, you know, and that's not a trivial thing. I mean, there's something going on there. And what's going on there has been that, you know, these issues, and I sometimes get yelled at by women for saying, you know, that we didn't know how much of a real voting issue abortion would be until Dobbs came along. It was all a hypothetical. You know, they were like, we knew women would do this or that. And I'm like, hey, guys, you didn't know anything. What you did was you believed, you thought things, you hoped for things, but you didn't know. And none of us knew because you'd never seen a fundamental individual liberty stripped away by the court in the history of the country. So it's like we give the history of the country has been a progressive expansion of rights, taking one away. Anyone who said they knew how salient and motivating an issue that would be knew is wrong because there was no precedent for it. As it turns out, it's a really big deal, at least on the basis of what we've seen so far in terms of turnout. It's part of the explanation of the not just beyond, oh, the polls are wrong all the time. There's also the disjuncture between where Democrats have been in polling and where they've been on election day has been that the power of Dobbs, and I would say more broadly, the power of the series of issues that Dobbs is at the center of that have allowed Democrats to paint Republicans accurately, I would say, as out of touch extremists. That's one of the issues. And now there's a penumbra of issues that go into that picture of the Republican Party headed by Donald Trump as being extreme and out of touch with the center of America. But Dobbs is at the core of that. And Democrats have successfully done that. And they're going to try to do it again. And you're pointing to an example in Florida where people have, it's not that they want to make abortion the only issue on the ballot, but they understand that it's like the linchpin issue itself is very important, but it's also connected to this other picture, which is this party is too extreme on a penumbra, on a variety of issues. And so, look, I think the Senate map, you'd be insane or really heavily wish casting to be like, all is well. You know, you'd be like that, right, like that, right. That dog in the burning building meme, you know.
That's right.
You
know, say coffee.
I mean, yeah. It's like, it's not the map is still the map. It's still a really tough map. And that outside the margin of normalcy, there's not a world where the Democrats like are picking up seats in the Senate. If the Democrats hold the Senate, it will be a very powerful thing. The map is very bad. And there's very few pickup opportunities. That's just the reality. But it may be not unreasonable to hope that the Democrats can put together enough holds that they can maintain a control of the Senate and or maybe, you know, end up at 50-50 again. And if Biden wins, that again gets you control of the Senate. It's not the likeliest outcome, but it's not an impossible outcome. And if it turns out to be possible, it will be because of this larger trend, which is that this issue set is motivating people against Republicans and for Democrats in a way that's really unprecedented, like a thing I've never really quite seen before. And all the time I've covered politics, it's just really been amazing to watch the way that abortion and then the larger set of issues have motivated people in a country that a lot of people have over many years have thought is like basically issues don't really move people. Turns out this one really does, and that collection of them. And maybe that will work to Democrats' favor again.
John, thank you so much. That was super important. Thank you. When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Neera Tanden is a domestic policy advisor to President Biden. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Neera.
Great to be with you.
I'm so happy to have you. I feel like there's so much going on in this White House. And like I was listening, you know, I'm like a big C-SPAN person, so I actually get to hear what the president says. And right, because that's the only place you get to hear it. And also the first lady talking about this, all this amazing cancer stuff they're doing with these people who can help you navigate the system.
I know.
Just very, very cool stuff. So I'm hoping you could talk to us first about what's happening in this admin when it comes to healthcare.
Great. You know, I can't think of anything I'd like to do more. I've been working in healthcare a long time. This is my third administration, my third Democratic administration, of course. And I've been working on healthcare in each administration. I started off in the Clinton administration. Obviously, I worked in the Obama administration and on the Affordable Care Act. What I think people lose sight of is how historic the actions the president has taken are, because we have the lowest rate of uninsurance ever. We've been able to do things that, you know, advocates have asked for, like, you know, really advocated for decades, like giving power for Medicare to negotiate drug prices that actually get drug prices down, and also do historic protections. We just put out a new rule to eliminate junk insurance. These are the short-term plans where you think you have insurance, and it's when you need it, it's really, there's no insurance there.
Like Liberty Health Systems, the company that funds CPAC, right? Liberty Health Share.
Exactly.
Yes, which turned out to be a fraud. Shockingly, the company that funded CPAC a couple times. Anyway, go on. Yes.
Shockingly, when Trump was president, he did a rule to expand junk insurance. I have no idea whether that's connected to any particular funder at all, but after saying, the difference is pretty stark. So when it comes to expanding coverage, lowering costs, you know, really trying to create protections for people and the healthcare system. The president has been laser focused and, you know, he really understands what it means for people. He really thinks through the anxiety people have in the healthcare system. He goes back to his own experience when he's been taking care of a loved one and how anxiety producing it can be. So, you know, I mean, it really is a North Star for him. As you started this conversation, I think it is hard to break through on some of these issues sometimes because it isn't, you know, sometimes when you have, say, historic numbers of people covered in the Affordable Care Act, 21 million people on the start of this administration, it was 12 million people. You know, it just doesn't break through because it's not a conflict or a fight. It's just a good thing that's happening. So I appreciate any opportunity to talk about it.
It must be like very gratifying, though, if you think about, I mean, for example, Obamacare is wildly popular, and it wasn't always. And I was thinking about, you know, there was so much strom and drama about that policy, the idea that you were going to be able to get health care. And then Trump desperately wanted to get rid of it and had to plan for a perfect health care that everyone was going to love in 2 weeks. And he will get rid of it if he can get back into office. We know that to be true. But what's happened since Obamacare, since the Obama advent, is that it's become actually really a way of life for a lot of Americans. I mean, is it gratifying to watch how popular it's become?
I thought the day would come. I mean, there were many years out there where it wasn't popular and right. We had to defend it. And I remember when Trump came into office and there were even some groups who thought we should, you know, we might just have to cave on allowing Obamacare to go. And, you know, I just thought that was crazy. And I also think that the fight over Obamacare has also made clear to millions of people, you know, what's really at stake. And the fact that 45 million people now have coverage because of Obamacare, 21 million in the exchanges, you know, close to 25 million in the Medicaid program, it really means like millions and millions of people rely on this healthcare coverage. The fact that now we're at 40 states have done Medicaid expansion, that it's become much less contentious, has strong support in the public. I mean, I find that gratifying, but I also think it's the basic fact that everything they said about it, you know, is going to create death panels or kill off private insurance was all crazy and wrong. And it is an important service. And affordability has been a key point. It is hugely popular now. It's growing. We got 5 million people in the last year alone signed up for exchange coverage, 3.4 million Latinos, 1.7 million Black Americans. And so, you know, it's hugely popular. It's having a particular impact on providing insurance to communities of color. But I also think I've lived through a lot of these fights, and the Republican Party has an ideological objection to Medicare and Medicaid. And Obamacare is front and center. And that's why, you know, last week, the Republican Study Committee put forward this plan. And it's like so radical, it's hard to believe. It's a they offer a $4.5 trillion cut to the ACA, Children's Health Insurance Program, Medicaid programs. $4.5 trillion over 10 years. It eviscerates all of these programs. They voucherize Medicare. And that's 80% of the House Republican caucus, married to Trump, who's already tried to get rid of it and like fought tooth and nail. And that's why I think we have to be really conscious that, you know, if you think it's crazy that they would try to rip away health insurance for 45 million people, that's what they do. This is an ideological fight. And so, you know, that's why I was really proud to see the president take this on Tuesday and really lay out the contrast in North Carolina and just drive, be really clear about what's at stake, because what they kind of rely on is their plans are so crazy, people don't take it seriously. And when we don't take them seriously, that is when things get scary. So that is why it's really important. And over the next several months for us to really be very clear about the differences.
Yeah, I love that Republican Study Committee because it's like all the crazy stuff you would expect to find in an Oppo file. They just put their names to it. You know, they're like, yeah, we want to cut the federal.
That's the point. It's not like they feel ashamed. That's like what they would like to do to America. Okay, so like,
yeah,
I think it's like good that they put it out because people can really see it. It's all in black and white. you know, basically transforming the Medicare program into a voucher program where people like have to pay more for coverage. You know, that's right there.
I mean, my favorite one is the Heritage Foundation being like, why isn't IVF better regulated? I'm like, you guys don't want to regulate anything but IVF. That's the one place.
Regulate anything other than women's body. That is okay to regulate.
Yeah. IVF. Suddenly IVF is the thing they're the most worried about. So that Medicaid expansion is a huge deal. And we don't cover it so much because in some states, you have red states with blue governors desperately trying to get it past state legislators, and attention does not serve. But it's going. I mean, this is happening in a lot of states. Does that mean more hospitals? Does that mean more coverage? I mean, can you give us just a little like explainer about what that looks like on the ground in a red state where they've done the expansion?
Well, I'm not going to give you a red state because it's very much a purple state. We were just in North Carolina, which had a Republican legislature and has a Republican legislature that has not done Medicaid expansion or had not done Medicaid expansion for years and years and years. Governor Cooper fought the long, hard fight to convince them to do the Medicaid expansion. They passed it. It's covering 400,000 people now in Medicaid, and it will cover 600,000. Just got implemented a few months ago, but ultimately will cover 600,000 people. And I'll just give you a great example of what it means. The president was introduced by a woman who was in the Medicaid, it was in the gap of coverage. So she didn't qualify for the base Medicaid program, but didn't make enough for the Affordable Care Act exchanges. So that's what was so crazy about this policy. If you were slightly higher income, you could get into the exchanges because those were federal. If a state hadn't done Medicaid expansion, people had no coverage. There was that group of people who had no coverage, which is so insane because, you know, she told the story, which is that she's slightly blind and she hurt her hand and she had to go to the hospital. She had an accident. She had to go to the hospital. She really needed emergency care. She was really worried about it because she didn't have health insurance. This happened in December, and she just got covered by Medicaid. So she was able to go to the hospital and not worry about coverage. And previously, she may not have gotten to the hospital. So it's just that kind of basic anxiety that people have when they don't have health insurance that, you know, if they get sick, they can't get coverage. But also what's really important about it is this is, you know, eventually why business groups supported it in North Carolina is that it really funds your rural hospitals. Rural hospitals disproportionately rely on Medicaid. In fact, in states that have expanded Medicaid, they've had much fewer rural hospital closings. In states that haven't expanded Medicaid, you know, like Texas, they've had a lot more rural hospital closings. And what that also means is that people just can't get the coverage they need in their community. And it's just such a counterproductive, ridiculous posture. So I'm so glad we're now at 40 states. But if you really think about it, just these governors who have not expanded coverage in their states, have not done a Medicaid expansion, are literally just choosing to not provide coverage to people out of spite. I mean, the reimbursement rate is like 95%, close to 100% for new states. It's really crazy. But, you know, I also think we have now a good spate of examples of states where, you know, they're doing the right thing. Virginia several years ago, now North Carolina, we're getting more and more coverage in more and more of the country.
Yeah, which is amazing. And again, this was a problem. Rural hospitals were unable. I'm thinking about this Lift Louisiana report that released last week, which had talked about just how there's healthcare deserts, there's hospital deserts, and then there's also maternal fetal health deserts. And then there's also, because of Republicans overturning Roe v. Wade and Trump's super Trumpified Supreme Court, you don't have OBGYNs in some of these red states, or you have many fewer than you need. Is there any way the federal government can help these women?
So far, there's some data that we've gotten that 10% of OBs in red states where, you know, Roe has been overturned and there is no right to abortion or there's a ban, we see, you know, that's a pretty significant decline of access to OBs. Like the challenge on Roe is it is really hard to undo, you know, when you have a constitutional right that's been there for 50 years and is undone. There are limited steps that the federal government can take in terms of just providing access to health care. You know, we've actually increased investments into maternal health. You know, we have a whole strategy around maternal mortality, which is really focused on trying to give support to hospitals, lower resource hospitals, hospitals in poorer communities, and really focused on trying to get them the resources for prenatal care. But the challenge with OBs is that, you know, we can't really make people work in states they don't want to. And so
right.
It is just hard. It's a really hard problem. I mean, when you basically vilify doctors and, you know, potentially criminalize, you know, basically where you have an abortion ban, you are criminalizing doctors who would provide the care. That is the target. You know, obviously, OBs are going to feel unwelcome in those states. And the president has heard from a number of doctors who just have left practice. He's actually heard from doctors who left practice in states because they're scared of, because they look at women they want to provide care to and can't because of these abortion bans. So, you know, that's hard.
Yeah. And that's what is, you know, I've heard so many stories from OBs about what it's like. And even like, you know, the story they don't want to tell you in Tennessee. I heard a story of a woman where they didn't want to tell her she was having a miscarriage. My doctor friend was saying, well, her numbers had gone down, down, down. So we knew that the pregnancy was not holding. And they didn't want to tell her, the patient, because they didn't want to do a DNC. And I mean, that is no way to practice medicine.
I mean, the fact that people know about their doctors, know of where a patient needs and tell them they need to get sicker in order to get the care because of a law in a state is just a crazy. But it also really speaks to the basic issue here, which is these laws fundamentally believe women's dignity should take a second, like take, you know, should take a sort of a second seat. You know, that fundamentally, these laws are really about controlling women. And I think that's the fight we're in. It is insane, but it's also, you know, that's the fight we're in. And we need to elect more people who think differently and who will pass a national law to protect Roe. That is what is in front of us. And this, you know, it's not my place to talk about politics, but in this election, you know, I mean, that's the choice that we have. We can allow this to happen or we can fight to change it.
It's craziness. Neera Tanden, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back.
I would love to. Always great to be with you.
Thomas Zimmer is a historian at George Washington University and author of the Substack, Democracy Americana. Welcome to Fast Politics, Thomas Zimmer. You're a historian at Georgetown,
yep.
Not bad. But you wrote about something that Jesse and I are obsessed with, which is Project 2025.
Right.
I think we actually agree on this idea that this is the sort of mainstreaming of anti-democracy may actually be its most dangerous facet. So give our readers first what Project 2025 is, and then let's go from there.
Over the past few months, detailed plans have emerged on the right for what they want to do upon getting back to power. There's different factions on the right. They're preparing separate plans. There's also rivalries between them. But Project 2025, I think, stands out among all these different factions and different plans. It was launched in April 2022 under the leadership of the Heritage Foundation. And it really unites much of the conservative movement, conservative think tank machine, the activists and lobbying groups behind the goal of installing a much more effective, much more ruthless right-wing regime. If you zoom out and sort of try to understand what is this Project 2025, I think it's best described as the American Rights Declaration of War on the idea of a multiracial, pluralistic, diverse society. It's a plan to execute what amounts to a comprehensive authoritarian takeover of American government, and then a plan to use government as a tool to impose a really extreme, a radical, reactionary agenda and vision for society on the entire country against the will of the majority of Americans. And it's really sort of this idea of a white Christian patriarchal order, and everybody has to adhere to that. So again, it's this comprehensive plan to take over government and then use it as a tool to impose that on society.
Let's talk about what that looks like. Give us some very concrete kind of examples of things that it wants to do.
I think it's important to note that there's, so broadly speaking, it envisions a vast expansion of presidential power over the executive branch of government. So that's the first thing they want to do. And then they want to dismantle certain parts of government, certain parts of the administrative state and federal agencies, while simultaneously mobilizing and weaponizing other parts. I think it's really important to keep them together at the same time, because they talk a lot about, oh, we want to dismantle the state. And, you know, to some extent, that's true. For instance, they say, oh, Department of Education, that needs to be abolished, like straight up abolished. Right. It needs to go. Or like the EPA, they want to deregulate a lot of stuff. So this is sort of the stuff that you would know from the conservative legal movement, like get out of here with all these regulations and everything that goes against moneyed interests. So that needs to go. But at the same time, this is not a like small government libertarian kind of vision, because they also identify everything that can be used. So basically everything that is a tool for government to create a fairer, a more egalitarian society needs to go. But everything that can be used as a tool to impose the sort of reactionary white Christian patriarchal order on society, oh, that needs to be mobilized and weaponized. So for instance, the Department of Health and Human Services, right? For them, that's not about public health. That's entirely about imposing sort of a white Christian reactionary understanding of, oh, there's man and woman and marriage is just between a man and a woman and whatever. Like, of course, like total abortion ban. That's how they want to use that. Or the CDC, for instance, which generally they hate, but also they want to create this sort of massive data bank at the CDC where every information about every abortion in the entire country is sort of centrally located at this one place. So this is not a small government libertarian vision, not at all. It's a vision of sort of weaponizing and then mobilizing the coercive powers of the state against their enemies.
Yeah, no, they're total liars. They want to use the government to get what they want. But this Project 2025 comes from the Heritage Foundation. So talk to us about the sort of Heritage Foundation and what part they play in this.
Yeah, so this is really important because I think some people still think, oh yeah, so Trump is crazy, right? And MAGA is crazy. And this is sort of the crazy right-wing fringe. But this is as establishment as it gets. This is not the fringe. The Heritage Foundation was established in 1973 during the Nixon administration, when still sort of the conservatives had this sense that just Nixon wasn't enough. They needed a more conservative sort of all these institutions to counter what they perceived as sort of liberal hegemony. So they created all these think tanks. And Heritage has always been the most important, the most influential conservative think tank, the one that is closest to power, that has sort of closest to the center of the Republican Party. It was associated with Reaganism and it associated itself with sort of Reaganism. But in recent years, it took a decidedly sort of Trumpian turn. And the guy who's currently in charge, Kevin Roberts, who became the president of the Heritage Foundation in late 2021, is very sort of instrumental in taking the Heritage Foundation in a much more openly radical, openly sort of pro-Trumpist direction. And so now they openly say our mission is to institutionalize Trumpism, by which they mean not like containing it or taming it, but making it more effective, right? Making it more efficient. And so what you have here, they brought all these conservative institutions, organizations together. Like I think as of right now, over 100 conservative institutions are listed as part of their advisory board, Project 2025's advisory board. And everyone you can think of, it's like a who is who of sort of reactionary organizations and institutions in America. So they brought them all together, unite them behind this project. And so what this really tells us is, there was an interview with Kevin Roberts in the New York Times in December, where he said something like, this is not the fringe, this is Heritage. And he's right, this is not the fringe. This is as conservative establishment as it gets. So this should tell us something about where the center, the power center of American conservatism, how much that has radicalized, how much that has moved to the right. And that is why I think this is so instructive to look at Project 2025.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's so interesting because they have a real plan for things. So tell me what else you have found where you're like, this is horrifying.
I'll say maybe so one more sort of detailed thing and then one big picture thing. So the more detailed thing is, like I said, this is a plan to dismantle some parts of government and then weaponize and mobilize other parts of government as sort of a tool, right? But all of this only works if you have the manpower to, like, to the right kind of personnel, the right kinds of people to put into these institutions of government, into these federal departments, into these federal agencies, into these federal commissions. They didn't have that in 2017. And they know exactly that they didn't have that in 2017, right? They didn't have the people, right? So they had to rely on, remember all the adults in the room and all that nonsense. But that was actually, it wasn't true in the White House, but it was true in sort of across the agencies in the federal government, all these sort of career diplomats or bureaucrats or experts, right? So this time, they want to get rid of all of these people. Underlying all this is this fever dream of a great purge of government officials. They want to come in, they want to fire and replace up to 50,000 federal employees by implementing something that they call, it's called Schedule F. It's basically the idea of sort of stripping civil service protections of like 50,000 people in order to make them fireable, right? And then replace them with what they themselves call, quote unquote, conservative warriors, right? This is explicitly what they're looking for. So they're right now they're engaged in this massive vetting operation where they're looking for, they're using an online questionnaire thing to find these sort of true ideological believers and put them in place everywhere. And again, this is a completely different thing, completely different animal compared to 2017. This is not just going to be Trump 2, is not just going to be more of the same of Trump 1. Not that the first Trump presidency wasn't awful, but this is going to be a completely different animal. And this is partly why they, like, no one understands better than these people that they were not ready in 2017. They didn't have plans. They didn't understand government. The people who Trump brought in had no idea what they were doing. And so this time they understand we need to be ready. We need to have the plans ready. And we need to have the people to put in place to sort of implement those plans. And I mean, again, like, this is as comprehensive as it gets. This should tell everyone next time they will be ready.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Over the past few years, I found one of the more frustrating things in American politics is if you try to describe to people who may not be paying all that much attention to American politics. By the way, this is not a criticism. It's just not everyone gets paid to do this, right?
No, I get it, man. Yeah. No, I get paid to do this. But yes, I agree. There's a lot of news fatigue, especially after Trumpism.
Absolutely. I get that, right? People need to live their own lives and they have stuff to deal with. That's okay. But then what makes it frustrating is when you describe to people, again, who don't pay all that much attention to American politics, how much the American right has radicalized and how radical these plans are, you get looked at like you have fallen off the deep end, that this is just some lefty, crazy conspiracy theory.
Right.
So it can be really difficult to convey to people, no, look, this is what they are saying. So in this respect, I think Project 2025 is actually tremendously helpful. I'm almost grateful to them for writing this down because, like, the right-wing leaders who are behind these projects, they could not possibly be clearer about the reactionary vision they want to impose on the country. They are telling us that they do not accept this egalitarian, pluralistic idea of a society in which the individual status is no longer determined by race, gender, religion, and wealth. And they feel justified in taking, like, really radical, extreme measures to prevent that society from ever becoming a reality because they believe they are defending, quote-unquote, real America in service of this higher purpose, the purpose of entrenching the, quote-unquote, natural order and divine will. And these are the kind of categories in which they think, right, in which they justify what they are doing. I tell people, look, if you don't want to believe me, fair enough, some lefty liberal professor who would trust me, fine. Okay, just read what they have to say. And I always tell people, look, okay, so they're putting out this sort of 920-page policy agenda report, which I don't expect people to read. But in that thing, and they have it on their website, you can just Google Project 2025, and they have this 920-page report on as a PDF document on the website, and you go to it. And in it, the president of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, he wrote the foreword to it. He's calling it a promise to America. So basically his promise to America, I'm going to call it a threat, but whatever. He calls it his promise to America, right? It's just right. Like 15, 16 pages, I think is what it is. And I just want everyone to just read this, just those few pages. It is so open. There's nothing in between the lines. You don't have to like translate or read between the lines. It is so open. It is so aggressive. It is sort of this visceral disdain for anything and anyone who deviates from this sort of white Christian patriarchal understanding of what society should look like. it could not possibly be clearer than that. And so I think, again, if you read this and you come away from this thinking, yeah, I like this kind of stuff, okay, whatever. Like, we probably can't be friends, but, you know.
You're probably not listening to this podcast.
Exactly. Like, I wouldn't expect that. But then, at least, you know, fair enough, you know what's up. But again, if you read this, at least you get a sense of what the stakes are in November. Because in a very concrete sense, this is what's on the ballot in November. It isn't really about Trump versus Biden. It's more, again, this is basically a referendum on whether or not the attempt to make America into a kind of democratic, pluralistic, multiracial society, to keep going on that path, whether or not that should be continued or maybe completely abolished, right? So this is sort of a thumbs up or down kind of vote on sort of democratic self-government and the civil rights order. I just don't see how that could be any clearer than when you read these 15, 16 pages that the Heritage Foundation's president put down there. And I'm, again, in that sense, I'm honestly kind of grateful for them for just writing it down and telling the world, also telling it, this is our promise to America. And then I think America should decide, do we like this or not?
Right. No, I agree. Obviously, on the left, we're all completely horrified. But one of the things about Trumpism is there's almost no pushback. You know, Trump says something crazy and, like, with very few exceptions, I mean, Mitch McConnell, who we know hates him, already endorsed him. So, like, I mean, is this just where the Republican Party is now? If Democrats were enacting a bold but insane and anti-democratic legislation, I think there'd be some pushback.
Yeah, no, I agree. So there are different factions on the right, and not everyone wants Project 2025 in charge, right? So Trump's campaign, they are working on their own sort of set of plans. They call it Agenda 47. There's the America First Policy Institute, like other sort of Trump administration alumni coming together. Like, they are working on their own plans. And these different factions, they're vying for power. They don't necessarily all like each other, right? So that stuff is definitely going on. But on substance, right, there is no disagreement about any of this kind of stuff. That's also why I find it very misleading when people sort of say, oh, these plans don't matter. Like, ultimately, Trump is going to be Trump, and Trump doesn't care about any of this kind of stuff, and he's not the kind of guy to implement, you know, a comprehensive policy agenda. Look, I agree, Trump's not going to sit down and read 920 pages of policy agenda.
But he'll put the judges in that they tell him to.
It's even more than that. I get it, right? So in some sense, he is not exactly an ideal vessel for the kinds of ambitious, comprehensive plans that they have here, because he's erratic, he's lazy, he's volatile, and he's not sitting down to, like, dive into this kind of stuff. And yet, right, he is sort of, he's animated by a spirit of vengefulness and grievance, and he's extreme. He isn't restrained by norms. And that is precisely why the right united behind him in the first place in 2016. They didn't want a quote-unquote normal Republican. They wanted someone who would take the gloves off, someone who would be willing to do whatever it takes in their sort of understanding of where America is. So they wanted someone who would certainly not reject Project 2025 because he thought it was going to be too extreme, or because he had qualms about questions of legality and precedent and all that. It takes a truly radical president in the White House to implement plans like these, because they are pretty radical, right? And that is Trump. That is Trump. If you compare these plans to what Trump himself says, what he wants to do, you know, in his sort of rambling speeches and rallies and all that kind of stuff, the general thrust of Project 2025 is entirely in line with what Trump wants to do with power, right? Purge dissenters from government, replace them with loyalists, expand presidential power, and make the executive into a tool for whatever the regime wants to do. Look, it doesn't take much sophisticated analysis to explain why such plans would appeal to Trump. He wants power, he wants impunity, he wants the ability to plunder.
He's an autocrat, yeah.
Right. And he will certainly not sit down again and read through the 920 pages of this sort of policy agenda report, Project 2025.
He certainly will not.
No. But Donald Trump, as someone with aggressively autocratic instincts and sensibilities, will look at this and think, oh yeah, I kind of like this, right? Like, giving me all this power and, like, purging my enemies from the states and punishing my enemies. And he likes all that kind of stuff. The idea that there will be some sort of internal friction that will sort of make this fail, I find that not plausible at all. This will work really well with what Trump wants to do.
Exactly. If Trump gets reelected, this is where we go.
Yeah.
Thank you, Thomas.
I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely. Anytime. Anytime.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Hi, Junk Fast. We know the Republicans don't believe in democracy, but then they sometimes do really, really hilarious things to show us some great examples of this. What are you seeing here?
Kentucky has a Democratic governor named Andy Beshears. He just won re-election. And one of the things, I mean, this is like so unbelievable. They, you know, you have this Republican state legislature and then a Democratic governor. So they were real worried about their two senators, but only one of them. And so they made it so now the governor doesn't get to replace a senator if they die. You know why they did this, right? Because Mitch McConnell is about to give up leadership, is extremely old, has been having some health issues. It's just such a craven power grab. And it's also set up, you know, in just a totally disgusting way. And for that, that is our moment of fuckery.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.